GTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show is next. Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Even though the COVID-19 crisis is really crowding just about everything out of the headlines, March still is Women's History Month. And so I'm very, very happy that I can bring you the interview that I have just recorded about a week ago with the author of a new book who explores the life and influence of two amazing women of the 20th century. Here it is. There is something tremendously exciting about being exposed to a fascinating story that you knew nothing about. Such is the case with a brand new book by Amy Shearer titled called Fighting for Space, Two Pilots and Their Historic Battle for Female Spaceflight. This is, in a sense, a dual biography of two endlessly fascinating women, both of whom were female pilots at a time when that was rather uncommon. In the case of Jackie Cochran, a friend of Amelia Earhart, it was exceedingly uncommon for women to be pilots. Yet Jackie Cochran managed to achieve all kinds of greatness in the air, breaking all kinds of different records. A generation later came Jerry Cobb, another gifted female pilot, who has the distinction also of being at the forefront of efforts in the early 1960s to put women into space as astronauts. And this was actually an undertaking which ultimately led her into conflict with Jackie Cochran in a really fascinating way. And all of this and more is explored in Amy Shearer Teitel's brand new book. Amy Shearer Teitel has written extensively on topics related to space and space flight. And this book, once again, is titled Fighting for Space, Two Pilots and Their Historic Battle for Female Spaceflight, published by Grand Central Publishing. As somebody who has written extensively about space and space travel, I suspect that you have known about the exploits of Jackie Cochran and Jerry Cobb much more than most of us. How long have you known about them? I mean, do you have any recollection of when you first became aware of their respective stories and of how fascinating these stories were?
Yeah, Jackie's actually a relatively new discovery. The Jerry's story and her kind of fight to get into space is actually a pretty well-known story, although typically it's told wrong. It's kind of told like this massive like feminist epic of this woman leading this group of 13 intrepid women trying to break down gender barriers in space. And it's a story that pops up pretty regularly in kind of space history circles and online. And when I really started researching for the book, I just thought there was always something that didn't add up about the story for me. Context is usually missing, but also I was really curious about this whole villain of Jackie Cochran because she was so one-dimensional, and I thought, this doesn't make any sense. So when I really started researching to write this book and started digging into Jackie is when I really learned just how phenomenal she is and wondered why no one knows about her, because she's such an incredible pilot, an incredible figure, an incredible woman. I mean, she did so many things that it was really, I got to discover Jackie, I really got to discover her writing this book, and that's why it's so fun exciting for me to share it with people finally is because I get to get you excited about how cool she was too.
So at the outset, were you intending this book to be what it turned out to be? That is, as I kind of described it, a dual biography of both of these women, really both of these women being given equal attention? Or at the outset, was this book perhaps going to look like something else?
It definitely evolved between the time of kind of hitting on the story of kind of women in space, this early kind of 1960s push, from kind of the first conceiving to write it to what actually it became. And really, it kind of initially I wanted to give it, really, it was going to be more kind of the typical story with more context, which is always missing in retellings. And, you know, as you do, as you kind of research something and you find how things really worked, it was, you know, discovering how involved Jackie was, that as soon as I realized, it was like, well, this is the story. It's not the story of women taking on NASA. It's Jackie's story, because everyone is a part of it, because Jackie knew everybody, which becomes really interesting. I mean, she knew the people at NASA. She knew LBJ, who was vice president at the time. She knew Randy Lovelace, who was running the medical tests that these women took, and her husband was one of the richest men in America and knew everybody and bankrolled everybody. And yeah, you know, as soon as I started getting into Jackie and realized the extent of her reach, it was like, okay, this is the story. And then it became a really fun job of seeing how involved Jackie was and how complete her involvement was.
Before we dig into some specifics, I wonder if we could talk about what I suspect was a vexing challenge for you, namely the fact that when we are talking about anybody, any historic figure who's larger than life, that often the stuff of legend and myth tends to spring up around them. And I am all but certain that that is the case when we talk about someone, for instance, as charismatic and exciting as Jackie Cochran, and that for you, trying to chronicle her life in as truthful a fashion as possible, it maybe is a tricky challenge to separate fact from the fictionalized or from what is sensationalized exaggeration of what in fact really happened or what in fact she actually achieved. What kind of challenge was that for you? And was it a greater challenge for one of these women versus the other in telling their story?
It was definitely a challenge for both of them. And with Jackie in particular, the most interesting part of that challenge is that she spun her own lies. So, you know, typically you read a memoir and you're like, this is the great starting point, I'll learn all about you. And then with Jackie, she has this whole story about how she was an orphan and her foster family didn't love her and all of this stuff. And none of that was true. She had a family and she knew them and she knew her real birth name. There's so much about her past that she hid that it was really actually quite fun to kind of discover her past and really give her, to me, it made her so much of a more interesting and a more layered character. You know, it wasn't just that she was a poor kid who got out and learned to fly. It's that she really reinvented herself. And lucky for me is that Jackie was an epic pack rat and she kept everything, of course, with the exception of her true backstory. So there's, you know, everything that you read in her memoir and think, this can't be true. There's letters that she kept that back it up, and you're like, this is a real thing that happened. So, you know, Jackie kept all the records, and I mean, I feel like we'll get into more of her in a minute, but among her friends was President Eisenhower. So all of her papers are actually in the Eisenhower Presidential Library, which is great because they're there and you can read them all. So I've got almost 5,000 pages of material from the archives, things that she kept and letters she wrote that kind of allowed me to verify what was true and in some cases, you know, verify the things that were very much her fabrications. And the same with Jerry. I mean, she also embellished in her memoirs and she wasn't Jackie. She didn't have, you know, her papers aren't in a presidential library. They're kind of scattered. So in a lot of things, there were still letters and still sources that were able to verify or go against what she said happened. For me, it was really just fun. I mean, that's kind of the fun of writing a story like this, is you get to do some detective work and ultimately what the real story that comes out is so much more interesting and so much more, you know, varied and textured than just a straight, this is a thing that happened and it was lovely. Like, no, it wasn't lovely, and that makes it so much more human.
How hard was it to come across all of this information? I suspect that it's not all housed in one single place. I mean, how arduous a process was it for you to find all of the information that is packed into this illuminating book?
Well, when you're an archival nerd like me, it's not arduous at all. It's actually really fun. So I went to two presidential libraries, the Eisenhower and LBJ libraries, because those are the two sitting presidents that were involved, and they were friends with Jackie, and their records are open, so it was easy to get to a good amount of stuff. The NASA archives has a lot about the space flight end of things, and all kind of, you know, the NASA characters. Again, they kept letters, they kept White House routing slips of things that were sent to Kennedy that were routed to NASA to deal with. I spoke to archivists and other archives that I didn't actually go to, because, you know, if you need one letter, you can call somebody and ask them to give it to you instead of flying across the country. So I spoke to archivists in various places all over the country, including, I even hunted down, I think it's, there's so many Montgomery counties in this country, I learned that. I think it was Montgomery County in Georgia, where Jackie actually got divorced before she was Jackie Cochran in 1926, and I was able to actually find her divorce record. A very, very lovely clerk helped dig it up for me. It's old enough to be public record, which is awesome. A lot of it was kind of finding out where things should be and finding the right archivist and getting the right piece of paper and you know, letting, what was great is that all these letters, all these documents, I could let the words speak for themselves and let the people speak for themselves, their own words, and really build the narrative out of all of this archival material I could dig out.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Amy Shira Teitel about her brand new book called Fighting for Space, Two Pilots and Their Historic Battle for Female Spaceflight. It is the dual story of Jackie Cochran and Jerry Cobb, women from two different generations, Jackie Cochran born in 1906, Jerry Cobb born in 1931. And for each of them, their ferocious love of flying and their determination to get doors opened up that might not immediately open to them. They both paved the way for other women pilots in a lot of exciting ways, and the story ultimately culminates with the quest for women to actually go into space. Amy Shira Teitel, one thing I appreciate about the book is that in the preface, among other things, you really lay out what amounts to a very brief history of women in America through the course of the 20th century, and those crucial moments in time when things changed in one way or another. I just wonder if you could say a word about why this is here, why you thought it was important to take the time to lay out this framework, most of which has nothing directly to do with the specifics of this story.
Well, I'm glad you read the preface, because I feel like everyone skips the preface and it's kind of important. As an historian, that context is really important, especially a story like this, because it's so easy to look at some of the, either the vignettes of the story or kind of the whole thing as a whole and look at it from a modern standpoint and think, well, this is just sexism. This is the issue. Like, why weren't they doing this? But you can't do that, because this is, you know, 50 plus years ago, depending on what part of the book you're looking at. And you can't take a modern standpoint at retro things or vintage things, because that becomes badly anachronistic. To understand what feminism meant in, you know, I'll take this as an example, what feminism meant in the early 1960s is really important, because I have three women in this book say, I am not a feminist. But to look at them from a modern standpoint, of course they're feminists. But feminist meant something very different in the early 1960s than it did at the end of 1960s, which, again, is very different than what it means now. So to have an understanding of the evolution of women in America, women's roles in America, how women were perceived in the media in America, allows you to really understand the story within its context and understand how and why they spoke the way they did and how they acted the way they did. Because otherwise, you look at it and you're like, well, why are they doing this? Because it was 1938, and you couldn't do things that you do now. But when you look at it in that context, you understand why they did it the way they did.
So the earlier of the two women who you discuss in your book, one Jackie Cochran, that is not her original name. When she is born, she is Bessie Pittman. I think we've already touched on why she began life with one name, and then it became this other name, and it was a case of wanting to, in a sense, rewrite the past. In a nutshell, what was it about Jackie Cochran's early life that she wanted so emphatically to leave behind her and also hide from the rest of the world?
I always default to calling her Jackie, but when Jackie was Bessie Pittman, Bessie grew up just incredibly poor. Her family was a mill family. They kind of moved from mill town to mill town. Her dad worked in the mill at one point, was a foreman in the mill, but, you know, they did not have a lot. Her brothers worked when they could. She was uneducated, and she wanted nothing more than to escape this slovenly mill town. She found role models where she could, including a second grade teacher who taught her about hygiene, and that kind of instilled in her this love of personal grooming and what she described and recalls as like a disgust or a distaste for how slovenly her family was. And from the way she writes about it and the way her family writes about her, both as Bessie and when she reinvented herself as Jackie, you kind of get the sense that she really just hated being that poor, and she wanted more from her life. She knew that she could get more if she worked for it, and she really wanted to just escape the cycle of working in a mill as a kid and marrying someone in a mill town and then mothering children that would then work in a mill. But she also still wanted a connection to her family. So it became this kind of balance of how do you do both? And, you know, the answer for her was reinventing herself and having secret connections to her family. She wanted more. She wanted a different life. And she found that for herself in the most complete way, down to creating a new name and hiding her backstory. I think part of her was probably ashamed of where she came from, because she ended up in such high society in America, you know, friends with presidents and unbelievable wealth for a long time. And coming from that poverty, I think, was a source of, you know, she didn't have pride in rising out of it. It was more shame of being from that.
Mm. One of the most intriguing points in the book, when you are describing her as a young person, is when you tell us by this point she's 14 years old, as being a striking young woman, equal parts feminine and tomboy. And this turns out to not just be true as she is a young teenager, but in some respects this remains true about Jackie Cochran for much of her life. Explain what I'm talking about and some of the ways in which this continued to always be true, that she was this intriguing mix of feminine and tomboy.
Yeah, Bessie, I'll swap names since we're using
right.
both names. Bessie was, I've seen, you know, younger pictures of her. She's quite beautiful. So even, you know, as a, somehow, you know, people in that era, she's 14, but like she looks 20, and I don't get it. But she was quite beautiful, and I think she knew it. And the way some people describe her, one of her nieces wrote a book about her way later in life, and in, I think the book was published in 2000. And this niece of her interviewed people that grew up in the neighborhood and stuff, and everyone just kind of remembers she had this attitude about her that she was really beautiful, and men knew it, and she knew that men knew it, and she would kind of leverage that. So she would be this beautiful young girl working in a beauty parlor by that point, kind of, you know, that was her way of escaping mill life. but she would also smoke behind the grocery store with the boys, which is a very unfeminine thing to do. And she used that as a way to kind of ingratiate herself almost with other people, so she could flip between being the perfect feminine girl in the beauty parlor, but also the girl that was so intriguing because she was bad and smoked with the boys. And, you know, she really did have that appeal, as evidenced by the fact that she was married by the time she was 14. She got knocked up. She got pregnant when she was 14 and was married to have her child not out of wedlock. And, you know, she really was sort of starting to fall into that cycle of mill life, but I think a lot of it was because she was using her wiles probably to attract maybe not the best kind of people, but it was small town mill life people, and she was falling into that.
Right. She ultimately, of course, probably earns more money early on working in beauty salons than in any place else, eventually starts her own cosmetics company. And again, this is just so at odds with what we might immediately assume would be kind of the persona and range of interests of somebody who is most famous for being one of the best women pilots of her day. So I just find this endlessly intriguing that she is as complicated a figure as she is. How much do we know about where she first, when and where and why, and how she first became interested in flying?
So just to hit on this, I mean, the duality of her kind of loving cosmetics and being very feminine in that way, and the flying thing, is why I think Jackie's such an interesting character. Like you said, it's an interest that you don't associate with people flying, and I love that, because from a modern standpoint, we always tell women, you know, if you're an engineer, you don't have to worry about being pretty, but, like, what if you want to? And I love that Jackie refused to make that distinction and that decision, that she was, why can't you be both? And she was both, to the most extreme possible. She started flying. Jackie was working in beauty parlors, and by 1929, 1930, she was actually making a lot of money. Even in the early Depression, you know, wealthy women didn't have to worry about skipping hair appointments. And, you know, women looking for jobs still needed to look presentable, so they were still going to their beauty appointments. So she was actually doing quite well and working in a very upscale salon in New York, and she really wanted to start her own cosmetics line, like you said, because she knew that she was good at doing hair and stuff, but that was limited. She wanted more. She wanted to get back out on the road. She'd done selling dress patterns in the past, driving from state to state, and really enjoyed kind of traveling and seeing the country. And this is the way that she tells it, so we're taking it with a bit of a grain of salt, because, you know, she embellished things. But she tells it that she was at a dinner party one night in Miami Beach in 1932, and she was sitting next to a man she knew as Floyd, and had no idea who she was, although I suspect she might have known that he was one of the richest men in the country at the time and finagled her way to sitting next to him. But over the course of the evening, they're talking, and she ends up divulging her kind of secret ambition of being more than a hairdresser, of actually starting her cosmetics company and selling cosmetics on the road and really making a name for herself. And Floyd kind of, you know, passingly says to her, well, you know, there's a depression on. If you're going to sell enough cosmetics to make a living, you need to cover more ground than you can in a car. Get your pilot's license. So, you know, that's not a common thing to say. Learning to fly in the early 30s wasn't unheard of. I mean, this is the era of Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart, you know. Everyone wants to be the next Lindbergh or Earhart, depending. So Jackie takes it to heart, and she says, all right. And it kind of becomes this game between them. They start dating, they start courting. And she says she's got 6 weeks of vacation. She wants to learn to fly. And he says, well, you're going to need way more than 6 weeks. And she says, well, I'll do it in three. And she ends up doing it in 17 days, which is unheard of at any point in time. That's so fast. She ends up having such a natural inclination in the air and such an instinct for flying that as soon as she gets her license, it's like, well, this is my purpose for being. And at this point, she's 26. She's not a kid doing it and falling in love. She's a full adult with a career, and she just decides to switch everything to flying at that point.
Right.
This is it now, and just takes to it, yeah.
I like the quote of the gentleman who gave her those pilot lessons, someone named Husky Llewellyn. And you tell us Husky had seen his fair share of young women come through the airport. They got it into their heads that they wanted to fly after taking a ride somewhere. Then they marched into his office intending to be the next Lindbergh, only to never return for a second lesson. And when this Husky Llewellyn looks at this young woman Jackie, and the way she's the way she looks, the makeup she's wearing, and so on, he thought she would be yet another who was not as serious about it as she maybe thought in the moment, and would not stick with it. And just the opposite was the case. She was maybe the best student, the most gifted student he'd ever had. And as you say, very quickly after that, she's flying.
Yeah, and not just flying. She starts winning awards. So she learned to fly in 1932, and by the end of the decade, she was a notable name in aviation. She won the Collier Trophy, the Harmon Trophy. She was the first solo woman to win the Bendix Transcontinental Air Race. She was the first woman to fly in a lot of typically male-only air races. And she was on things like the Collier Trophy Committee. She was a decider of who was going to win awards in aviation. She was very well known, and of course, all of her, you know, articles about winning races would mention that her new cosmetics line is on sale in the fall. And she really was doing both parts of her were becoming significant forces in America in less than a decade of her learning to fly and starting a company.
By the way, we should certainly mention the important friendship between Jackie Cochran and Amelia Earhart, who was an even more famous aviatrix at this point in time. Describe, in a sense, sort of the meaning and dimensions of their friendship and some of the significant things that they managed to do together on behalf of the cause of getting more women to fly.
Yeah, they had a very interesting friendship, and I think, again, learning about this, it's really weird to me that everyone knows Amelia Earhart. They're constantly talking about her disappearance, and no one ever talks about Jackie. They met through a friend in 1935, and very quickly kind of recognized that they were very similar. And because they were both going after different types of records, they had like a friendly competitive friendship. They weren't actually ever competing to win the same records. So Amelia was doing these long distance flights, which Jackie didn't really have an interest in, and Jackie was doing speed records that Amelia never had an interest in. So not long after they met, they flew across the country in Amelia's new Lockheed Electra. And over the course of that trip, they got hit with weather delays and storms. It took them over a week to make the trip, which should be a couple days at the time, and they became really good friends out of it. They realized that they agreed on a lot of things, and they had this interesting shared love of ESP. And they would actually use it and try to channel Jackie as a medium to find air crash sites, and then they'd go out flying to find it, and more often than not, they could actually locate a disaster site and help rescue efforts get to survivors. Amelia was the only woman or person ever that was allowed to sleep in Jackie's bed when she was visiting Jackie's house if Jackie wasn't home. She would frequently visit the Cochran Odlum Ranch and just stay either alone or with guests or with her husband, George Putnam. So they became very close. And they did a lot together to try to open these races for women, like the Bendix I mentioned that Jackie won in 1938. Women had been campaigning to fly in it for a long time, and using Amelia's star power at the time, women did eventually force their way into the race. In 1934, I believe, women were allowed to fly under the understanding that they were in a different category than the men, and women boycotted it that year because that was unfair. In 1935, Jackie and Amelia were the first two women to actually enter the race in a year that it would be the men and women racing together. So they kind of had that first. And Jackie didn't finish, and Amelia placed third that year. And they really did kind of band together to bring it about such that women could fly in some of these things. And I think in a lot of cases for Jackie, it was because she she wanted to be the best pilot. I mean, she says that she wanted to be the best pilot, not among women, but among people, which meant she had to break down those barriers. And yeah, her motivation was quite self-serving, but she wanted to do it. And the fallout of that is that women had a chance to prove that they were just as good as men.
Right. And even the disappearance of her dear friend Amelia Earhart in Amelia Earhart's effort to circumnavigate the globe was not enough to dissuade Jackie Cochran from continuing to fly. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Amy Shira Teitel about her book Fighting for Space, Two Pilots and Their Historic Battle for Female Spaceflight. I want to make sure that we have at least a couple of minutes to talk about the important work that Jackie Cochran undertook during the Second World War, establishing something called the Women's Flying Training Detachment, which I think we can think of as a precursor to the Women's Air Force Service Pilots Program, or the WASPs. This was an important undertaking for Jackie Cochran, but also one that ultimately was fraught with all kinds of frustration and some disappointments as well. Explain just how complicated this story is, and what a complicated experience it was for Jackie Cochran herself.
Yeah, this vignette, this whole Second World War stuff is so complicated. It was actually the hardest stuff to write, because there literally are books about this program and about this era, and distilling it down into just what was super relevant to just Jackie was just like, there's so many details and so many acronyms. But yeah, so It all started because Jackie, I mean, again, we know she's self-serving. We're aware of that. She had this ambition of being the first woman to fly a bomber overseas, and she was given that chance, and she took it. And she kind of wanted to do more for the war. So she started working in Europe with what was called the Air Transport Auxiliary, or the ATA pilot, which was anyone flying in Britain that was somehow disabled or unable to be a fighter pilot of sorts. So it was, you know, pilots that had lost an eye, pilots that were, you know, had lost a leg but could still fly. And this, of course, because women weren't flying for the military at the time, this included women. So Jackie ended up working in England for 6 months with the ATA pilots, looking at specifically the ATA girls and how they were flying and how they were supporting the war effort. And she realized that U.S. women could do the same thing if and when the U.S. entered the war, the idea being, well, you need all these fighter pilots on the front lines in Europe. You need them doing this work. Why not use women to free them up for that really necessary work and let the women fly everything at home, which is what eventually ended up being. And it was hugely complicated because there was other programs that were established first, with, like, women that she had rivalries with, and, you know, they go head-to-head, and they fight, and it gets really complicated. But in the end, Jackie ends up founding this program, which becomes the WASP, the Women's Air Force Service Pilots. And they do everything that the men are doing, but they just do it at home, freeing up the men for the combat roles that they're needed, for which they're needed. These are women who are, you know, towing targets for pilots learning how to shoot in the air, which I don't know about you, but I do not want to be the one towing a target for someone learning how to shoot from a plane. When airplanes were repaired, they would take them out for test flights. When, you know, cadets needed to be trained for something, the women would do some of the training flights. I mean, they were doing everything men were doing except fighting in the front lines. So it was a really important program, and it had a really important follow-up, but it got really complicated because the Air Force, of course, wasn't a separate service branch at the time. It was under the Army Air Force. And Jackie didn't want her pilots militarized as soldiers. She wanted them as pilots because she knew that that was an important distinction in the Air Force to get its co-equal independent status, which it was already fighting for. She wanted to help and to make sure that her pilots were under the Air Force, not the Army, and she ended up holding out for militarization under Air Force and didn't get it, which meant that all of the girls that she trained didn't have military benefits, and it became this big scandal. And it was hugely complicated, and it ultimately did a huge amount to prove that women could do anything in the air that men could do, including flying a bomber, which at the time did not have hydraulic controls. You're muscling the surfaces on this massive, you know, B-17. And she proved that women could do all that, but it also came at the cost of the detriment of that she didn't get the girls militarized and that she looked really bad for it.
Mm. It looked like it was perhaps some of her tendency to be self-serving that perhaps led to that decision being made. It was a painful moment for her that you write very honestly about. We need to shift to the younger of these two female pilots whose story is also told in your book, one Jerry Cobb. She's born in 1931, so about a quarter of a century after Jackie Cochran is born. And it's interesting, first of all, to see how in those years some things had become a bit easier, and yet in some ways Jerry Cobb faced all kinds of difficulties, especially given her love of flying and her gift for being a pilot, how difficult it was when she started looking for a job to find a job as a pilot. And of course, it's a case of the worst possible timing. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, oh, Jerry had some advantages that Jackie never had, because flying for a woman or for a girl wasn't as uncommon in the 1940s as it was, you know, when Jackie was growing up before people were flying at all. So Jerry learned to fly when she was a teenager because her dad learned to fly, and they had a small little plane, a little Taylor craft. So she was able to start taking flying lessons with her dad when she was 12, and she took them in high school, and she got her pilot's license at 16, on her 16th birthday, which was before she could drive. And again, not uncommon for people to do. Neil Armstrong actually did the same thing. He got his flying license before his driving license. So Jerry really grew up in the air. Once she took her first ride, she knew that was it, and she got her licenses as she was able to, as soon as she could, and she managed to support herself as a pilot as a young woman. But that didn't mean it was easier for her to find a flying job, because when she's starting to get on the job market in the early 1950s, the country's kind of flooded with pilots, because all these men who learned to fly during the war, you know, they're looked at as more seasoned, more accomplished pilots than a girl who's been flying just as long but didn't have, you know, combat experience or has flown as many kinds of aircraft. Not to mention the world is, you know, there's a shift happening in the country in the 1950s, where during the war it was all about getting women into the workforce to help with the war effort. Now it's all family values, get the women back home, taking care of the men. So not only does she not have the same experience as the men, but her, you know, the gender role reversal has happened, and she's not supposed to want to work for a living. So Jerry's up against all of these things trying to find a flying job, and she ends up kind of getting hired a few places because she's a novelty. The novelty of a woman flyer is sort of like that weird thing of, well, maybe we'll try it. And she ends up, you know, falling into a few roles, and, you know, she's daring and determined enough that she's given some opportunities to take on flying jobs and is able to continue that as a career.
Including a memorable flight she makes down to South America, a flight that nobody else wants to do, and which ultimately leads to her being detained in one of those countries for a time. That's a really good example of the kind of thing she was willing to take on, and our listeners can read more about it in your book. Ultimately, what Jerry Cobb is best known for is for the role that she played rather early on in the space program. And it's important for our listeners to understand this group known as the Mercury 13, that she had a real role in a sense, creating, and she was the one who, in some respects, led the way. Explain this very early facet of our space program.
Well, I feel like I should start by just clarifying that Mercury 13 wasn't a real thing. The term was
it's a nickname, right. Yeah.
It was invented by a Hollywood producer in the 90s. So I feel like, you know, to give them the name of the Mercury 13 implies that they were a group that was united, and that couldn't be further from the truth, which was really the fun in writing this book and really digging into the story and, again, finding all those letters, is to see how much the women didn't agree and how much they were not a united group and how much this was really Jerry willing something to exist that didn't exist. So it all started because in 1959, when America met its first group of astronauts, the Mercury astronauts, they became instant rock stars, and everyone was fascinated. You know, space was new and exciting and daring, and no one knew who was going to go or who was going to die in space, because, again, it was very sketchy. And the part of the testing had been, you know, psychological and everything, and medical testing. And through some means, and I deliberately make this a little bit ambiguous in the book, because there's a 1972 letter from Floyd Odlum to Jimmy Doolittle kind of puts everything that Jerry says in her memoir, kind of just tears that apart. Jerry ended up taking the same medical tests that the male astronauts, the Mercury astronauts, took in the spring of 1960. Now, these were medical tests done at the Lovelace Clinic in New Mexico, and, you know, if anyone's seen The Right Stuff, it's that sequence where they're getting, you know, needles jabbed in their hand and running down the hall with enema bags. You know, that's real, and that's what Jerry did. And it's interesting. We have to note that not only was Randy Lovelace a very good friend of Jackie Cochran, but Floyd Odlum, Jackie's husband, was not only bankrolling the clinic, he was chairman of the board of the Lovelace Foundation. So nothing is happening in that clinic that Floyd and Jackie don't know, and that becomes very important as Jerry's campaign goes on. So Jerry takes the medical test, and you can't really pass the medical test, but she does, you know, well. And Randy Lovelace announces that she did it in a medical conference in Sweden in August of 1960. And very much in the same way that someone publishes a paper now saying there's more evidence of past water on Mars, and then the media starts with, there's water on Mars. Well, that's not true. Well, when Randy Lovelace says a woman passed the test given to the Mercury astronaut, the media hears the word woman and astronaut in the same sentence, and all of a sudden there's a woman astronaut program. And there wasn't. And Jerry kind of is like, well, maybe if I run with this momentum, I can will it into existence. So this is where the story gets really messy and really complicated and really fun. Randy Lovelace wants to get more data points on women, so Jerry starts giving him some names. He also asks Jackie to advise on this because she's been flying. She's been her, there's so many pronouns. Jackie has been Randy's guinea pig for testing for so long. He's been using her flight data in his practice for so long that he asked Jackie to start giving women's names for further testing. And it's never this group of women that goes at the same time, because it wasn't a government-funded thing. It was funded by Jackie, because she kind of wanted to, A, help see it happen, but, B, also be the controlling decider. So these women are going through in ones and in twos over months. They start testing in January of 1961, and the last one was in August. I mean, this is far from a united group. And it ultimately ends up with 12 women, in addition to Jerry, quote-unquote, pass, you know, prove physically fit enough. One ends up withdrawing her name from future testing because she's going through a divorce. So it's not even 13 women in the end. It boils down to 12. But it becomes this whole thing where, you know, the men had to do psychological testing as well as simulation testing. So Jerry decides to do it herself. She does her own psychological testing, which is completely separate from anything, and tries to get the other women to do it, but it's not paid for. You know, only two can actually go through it, and the results don't matter. And they all end up going into this testing phase at the Navy's Pensacola station in Florida, which is the simulation testing. And somehow Jerry ends up going first, and kind of appoints herself this quote-unquote group's leader by virtue of her doing of the testing first. And it's all, I mean, these women never met as a group. It's all just letters flying across the country from Jerry, from the women, from Jackie, from Randy Lovelace, from NASA to NASA. And it just becomes this massive mess of, like, she said, he said, of who's in control, who's doing what the status is of this quote-unquote program, whether or not it is a program. And it all kind of hits the fan when all the women are supposed to actually finally go as a group to the simulation testing in Florida in August of 1961, again, bankrolled by Jackie. And it's canceled with no explanation 5 days before their intended arrival. And for some women, they're like, well, I guess we're going back to work, and they don't really do much more. And For Jerry, it's like, well, I need to find out why my dream has just been cut short. And she goes on this campaign in Washington to find out who canceled the testing. And she's writing letters, Jackie's writing letters, and it all gets to the point of the two women, as well as the third woman, Jamie Hart, another pilot, testifying before Congress in this congressional hearing on qualifications of astronauts to make sure women are not being discriminated against. And it just becomes this huge mess. And it never gets resolved, and it kind of dwindles, and it becomes this really weird thing of, what just happened? And it really is just women fighting individually for what they want versus what the group wants, and there's no consensus, and it's a mess. It's a fun mess.
Right. Well, it's a fun mess for you as the author who kind of chronicles it. And it's such an interesting cautionary tale, because it kind of tells us that when it comes to certain undertakings, it's not just enough to be forceful and determined and even resourceful, but you need to have an understanding of how things work, of how things get done, and you need to have an understanding of when something is, in a sense, bigger than you are. And it sounds like some of the principal participants in this initial effort just did not grasp all of that, and that's one reason why these initial efforts amounted to nothing. If anything, they perhaps set the cause back. Remind our listeners, how long is it before the United States waits for its first female astronaut to go into space?
It was 21 years between the hearing in 1962 and Sally Ride flying in 1983. So yeah, it's you're right. It's women trying to break into a male dominant field in the early 1960s. I mean, that's a recipe for needing to know how to play the game. And if you don't know how to play the game, you're not going to get there. And, you know, Jackie knew how to play the game, and she knew what was possible and what was doable, and Jerry was trying to force her way in without playing the game. And it's, you know, again, you have to remember that it was the early 1960s. This is before the second wave of feminism. This is before women's liberation. And putting it in that context, you realize just what these women were up against and why playing the game mattered.
Neither of these women are with us. Jackie Cochran died back in 1980. She did not live long enough to see a woman, an American woman, go into space. Jerry Cobb just died in 2019. I don't recall if you had the opportunity to directly connect with her at all.
I did not. She was notoriously reclusive, and I found people that had contact numbers for her, but they were with a very strict do not disturb warning, and I was trying to get some people that I knew were actually friends with her, not just business contacts, to maybe appeal to her, you know, politely, and I want to respect that she didn't necessarily want to relive this. She's written two memoirs. She's written a lot of articles about it. There's a lot to go on. And ultimately, I was not able to get someone to kind of give me the okay to contact her before she passed.
Well, despite that, this book is replete with one fascinating story after another, and it is such an illuminating profile of two utterly fascinating women, Jackie Cochran and Jerry Cobb. And the book again is titled Fighting for Space, Two Pilots and Their Historic Battle for Female Spaceflight, published by Grand Central, the author Amy Shira Teitel. Amy Shira Teitel, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, something that may especially appeal to all of you book lovers out there, and certainly during this COVID-19 crisis, a lot of us, as we are hunkering down, are spending a lot more time with books. One of my all-time favorite Morning Show interviews about books is with a guy named Sean Messing, who is the editor of a really fascinating and inspiring book called Bound to Last, 30 Writers on Their Most Cherished Book. 30 different writers write about the book the physical book, which means the most to them. So it's not just what is the represents the contents of the book, what's on the pages, but also the book itself, who gave it to them and when, under what circumstances, why does it mean so much to them. A really, really wonderful book about books. And you'll hear that interview tomorrow on Wednesday, an interview I just recorded last Wednesday with Ginny Sassaman. Many of you recognize the name from Jennifer Sassaman from the theater faculty at UW Parkside. Ginny Sassaman has studied and written about and talked about happiness for many years, and her new book on the